Have you ever wondered if there's any truth to the old saying, red skies at night, sailors delight, but red sky in the morning, sailors take warning? There's more truth than you think, says David Phillips from Environment Canada. And we'll take a look at the secret life of clouds with Gavin Praetor-Pinney, founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society in Great Britain. We're scanning the horizon for mirth and myth, rhymes and reasons, trivia and whimsy. It's all here on Jet Streaming from Minnesota Public Radio.
Beyond the blue horizon waits a beautiful day.
Welcome back, weather fans. I'm Kathy Werzer, host of Minnesota Public Radio's Morning Edition program. Our weather team of Paul Huttner, Craig Edwards, and University of Minnesota Climate and Meteorology Professor Dr. Mark Seely are all off this week, so we're bringing you a special best of show, taking the opportunity to answer some of your requests to hear a special guest or topic again. First up on the program, the folklore of weather with David Phillips, senior climatologist for Environment Canada. David is not only Canada's favorite weather guru, he's the originator of the wildly popular Canadian Weather Trivia Calendar. David's an author. He appears regularly on the Weather Channel and the Discovery Channel. We asked David why the weather is such a big topic of conversation among Canadians.
Canadians are favorite people to talk about the weather. They say we're boring because we talk about the weather so much, but I would think that people in Minneapolis and Minnesota and the great Midwest part of the United States are also weather weenies like we are here in Canada.
We are indeed.
Absolutely.
So, David, do you have a favorite bit of weather folklore?
Well, I do. I mean, I love the ones that really have a lot of rhyme to them. When the ditch and pond offend the nose, then look for rain and stormy blows. That's one that I think there's a strand of truth to that. When those ditches and ponds smell a little bit more than one day versus the other, you can be sure that perhaps maybe there's a low pressure system coming in, allowing those putrid smells to leave the ditch and pond, and perhaps that maybe is telling you that a storm is coming your way. But if there's a high pressure area that where there's no weather, then my gosh, maybe it's the pressure's keeping those smells in the pond, and you don't smell them as well as you do. So that's the one I like. But my gosh, there are so many of these pieces of weather lore that have been around for centuries that I find them amusing, and not that I follow them, but I certainly find they're full of merriment and amusement.
Oh, I love the descriptions too. Am I to maybe believe that many of these little bits of folklore may have a strand of accuracy in them?
Well, I think so. I often will play what I call weather charades with young people. I kind of encourage teachers to introduce weather lore when they're in their unit on weather to connect with our ancestors and how, my gosh, 150 years ago, there was no weather service in Canada, the United States, and our ancestors and mariners and gatherers and hunters. They were keen observers of the sky. They far better than we are today, because their lives and livelihood often depended upon it. So they sniffed the air and wetted their finger, and they observed the kinds of clouds and the various colors of the skies. And they can often, based just on sheer observation, make some deduction as to the kind of weather that's coming your way. So certainly, this is how people forecasted the weather long ago, but I think that what I like to do with young people is to throw out one of these items, like red sky at night, sailors delight, red sky in the morning, and sailors take warning. I mean, and to look at really the strand of truth that has allowed that to stand the test of times for centuries. I mean, that's a biblical expression, so my gosh, it's been around here for many, many centuries, so there must be some truth to it. And so what I look behind is the physics and the logic to say, well, gee, what works here? And not that I would encourage them to wake up in the morning and to use that to plan their day, but hey, it's something that makes them just a little bit more observant of their surroundings, and to eke out the kind of truth to it is a lot of fun.
David, having taught here for about 30 years and done a lot of programs with school-age children. I think that it's the weather folklore that sometimes, especially in the elementary ages, really captures their attention and starts to get them to think about nature a little bit and the environment around them. And I agree with you wholeheartedly. Some of these that have stood the test of time, for example, here in our region, we have the long-standing one about dew. When the dew is on the grass, rain will never come to pass. When grass is dry at morning light, look for rain before the night. And during the convective season, during the summer season here in Minnesota, and I suspect across southern Canada as well, this has certainly a degree of truth to it.
Oh, absolutely. And golfers and gardeners, when they'll often remember those little ditties and will plan their day accordingly. And my gosh, it doesn't work all the time, but it works enough times to be believable and useful. So I think you're absolutely right. I think the weather lore that seems to have any strand of truth to it, any hope of being successful, of course, is the weather lore that looks at the next hour or 2 hours or maybe one day. Anything beyond 48 hours is maybe just pure hokum. There is weather lore that really tries to forecast the season ahead. One of my favorite ones is when the squirrels early start to hoard, winter will pierce you like a sword. My gosh, these squirrels are gathering nuts and acorns mushrooms, they forget where to put them, and they put them, so they're not giving you any sense at all as to what the weather is going to be. The other one I kind of like too is onion skins, very thin, mild winter coming in, onion skins thick and tough, coming winter cold and rough. I mean, it's absurd to think that when you cut open an onion, you see those rings, that it will somehow tell you what the season ahead is going to be. It's probably telling you more about what you've gone through in terms of the growing season, the moisture that was available, and the thermal properties, rather than what the winter ahead is going to be like.
Tell someone from the Climate Prediction Center that would be nice. Craig, do you have a question?
Well, I'd like to jump on board with this because I'd like to be outrageous enough to suggest that folklore should be taught academically as part of a meteorological curriculum.
What?
Because I've seen meteorologists sit in front of computer screens and not go outside and sniff the air, observe the clouds. When I first started out in the 70s, every hour we went out and observed the weather conditions. Now they sit in front of a computer screen looking at computer models, and I think weather folklore, and if you look at the information that's there and say, now why logically would this make sense? And then I think that one of the challenges ought to be for them to create or make an observation to initiate a new weather folklore term so that they can say, back in 2007, I was the one that made that observation. Because I was wondering, has weather folklore finished, or are there still opportunities to originate weather folklore?
Well, that's a very interesting, I think that's a great challenge, one that I think would be a lot of fun, both entertaining and, but I think a key to what Craig is saying is that, my gosh, I mean, the very first step in making any forecast is to observe your current conditions. And sometimes I think meteorologists, forecasters are at fault looking at their satellite and radar imagery and not just looking outside and seeing what's cooking. So I think this is, I think part of the purpose of teaching young people is to, as Mark said, is this notion of observing. I mean, to just observe your surroundings, because it helps us connect with the environment, not just the weather, but the entire environment. And so it's a lot of fun, but also has a good purpose in mind too.
So maybe David, for the Canadian Weather Trivia Calendar, you can ask folks to maybe cook up a new bit of folklore.
Well, you know, it's a good idea. I often put little challenges in there and little quizzes, and that's certainly one. I know that we've in Canada, we have most of the folklore that I've seen in North America comes from Europe, and that's why some of it doesn't work, because folklore doesn't always move well from one region to another. My gosh, from one neighborhood to another, it doesn't necessarily hold true. And some of our ancestors ancestors, when they came over to the New World, they brought that weather wisdom with them. And my gosh, when they didn't see certain animals or plants that they used in Europe, well, they just conscripted some to use that in place. I think the famous one is the groundhog. I mean, they don't really have groundhogs in Europe. They had marmots and other creatures, but hey, that the groundhog looked like one of these creatures, and the hedgehog, and it became the weather prognosticator, and of course is famous today on Groundhog Day when people look at these furry friends to find out whether winter is over or whether it will come again. In fact, there is a little piece of folklore that that relates to the groundhog. I think if the groundhog how does it go? If the groundhog day be fair and bright, winter will have another flight. But if the groundhog day brings cold and rain, winter is gone and won't come again. So I think the one thing that I find so entertaining is the rhyme. Now, sometimes our ancestors were more keen on the rhyme than they were on the logic. And they would sort of force something to fit a kind of a clever little couplet and just threw any hope of science or logic out the window. And sometimes these things have are sort of fall down because of that.
Say, David, a quick bit of trivia and then a question for you. The quick bit of trivia is, believe it or not, our state low temperature record here in Minnesota is Groundhog Day 1996, minus 60 up at Tower, Minnesota.
Now, that's in Fahrenheit, is it?
That's in Fahrenheit, yeah, right.
It's hard for me to get my head around that, but anyways.
That was a Groundhog Day to remember.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. You know, Mark, that's interesting that we have also Groundhog Day's weather events here in Canada. I remember a famous storm in New Brunswick where it happened on Groundhog Day, and people remember what they had for breakfast on that particular morning.
Oh,
they can't remember last week. But my gosh, on a day that is so weather, we have that emotional attachment. We can remember every moment of the day, what we did on that day with weather as being the backdrop.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a bookmark. My follow-up question for you, David, having studied this probably more than certainly most people we know, in terms of weather folklore, do you feel like there's more embedded in the cultures of the mid to high latitudes than there is the subtropical latitudes? It seems like where people experience the sharp seasonal changes, you know what I mean, and the great variation in weather, it seems to me there's relatively more weather lore than there is in other places.
I think so, Mark. I'm not a great student of it, but I certainly think when I look for the different kinds of weather lore that you find them from really mid-latitudes. Also, even just conversation. I think the fact that people talk about the weather. I mean, Americans from Maine to Montana talk about the weather, as do Canadians and Europeans. But, my gosh, I go to the tropics, and people think you're boring if you talk about the weather because you could set your watch to the weather. I mean, why would you talk about the weather? I mean, people would say, I'll meet you after the rain, when they just know at 5:45 the rain is going to end or the sea breeze will blow up. I mean, at least our weather is not as monotonous as it is in some of the lower latitudes. And so I think weather is, of course, important to them, but they don't often put these sayings to rhyme. They don't necessarily seem as preoccupied as the fact that, as we are, where, you know, if the weather changes so dramatically, we often say here in Canada, if you don't like the weather out your front door, look out your back door. And because it changes so dramatically, I think that people are more interested in the weather. I think people in Minnesota are more interested in the weather than people in Florida or in Arizona. And in Florida, they're interested, of course, maybe during the hurricane season and in the monsoon season in Arizona, but they often just worry whether the sky is going to be a little bluer from one day to the next, where, you know, the weather can attack you from every direction in where you are and certainly up here in Canada. So I think that certainly drives the interest in it, and also I think it has to our ancestors. That's why it's really a hotbed of weather lore. Although I find that most in this country, you don't see a lot of original folklore. That's why I like kind of Craig's exercise, where people could come up with a little ditty and put it to rhyme and create something new. A lot of it is very old. We often, our Aboriginal people often speak in fables or in stories rather than in pithy little weather ditties like we got from Europe. So, but it's certainly alive and well, and I'm happy to see that that young people here in Canada often know a little bit about weather lore. I hope it's not just seniors who enjoy these things.
This is Craig Edwards. Before I used to go off to work and try to figure out what the probability of rain was going to be for the day, I used to ask my wife how her knees were feeling. But because then I'd get if the achiness was up, I'd say, well, the chances of rain is increasing. But now her knees ache every day, so that's not a clue to me anymore. So,
oh, my.
But I've got one for you that says something about a rooster. When a rooster goes crowing to bed, he will rise with a watery head.
Oh, that's a good one. I've actually heard that one, but it's nicely put, and I thank you for reminding me. Here's one that I think is kind of a modern one. You think about, you have your morning coffee, and here's one. If the bubbles rising in your coffee cup, in fair weather you will sup, but if they break and burst apart, rainy weather soon will start. So when you go and you're just staring in your coffee, you could... And those bubbles breaking or not breaking, you might have a sense of what the weather in the next hour or two is going to do.
That was David Phillips, Senior Climatologist of Environment Canada and the originator of the Canadian Weather Trivia Calendar. Dave is also an author, and he appears on the Weather Channel and the Discovery Channel. Everybody's seen the famous Peanuts comic strips of Charlie Brown and Schroeder, Linus, Lucy, and the gang taking turns at gazing up at the sky and seeing pictures in the clouds. Well, according to Gavin Praetor-Pinney, there's more to cloud watching than meets the eye. Gavin is the founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society and a prolific author on the subject, including the Cloud Spotter's Guide. Gavin visited with us last year, and we asked him when he first started looking upward and gazing at the clouds.
Well, it was when I was a kid, so there was nothing special about that. It's something that kids do, isn't it? And when I was, I suppose 4, 5, 6, around that age, I first became interested in clouds. I remember looking up and seeing one with the rays of sunlight that you sometimes see behind, breaking out from behind a cloud. I now know they're called crepuscular rays. But at the time, I just thought, what is that thing up there? And these rays made me, I guess, attracted my attention. And I thought, what is it? What's it made of? Why is it there? And what would it be like to sit on it?
Why do you think clouds hold such a fascination for humans?
Well, I think they are, there's something contradictory about them. They're both objects, and yet you can't touch them. They have no, they're bodies without surface. That's what Leonardo da Vinci called them. And so there's something intriguing about clouds, but then the other thing is that the way they change, they're in constant flux, this ephemeral nature of them where they're never the same for two moments. This seems to give them an emotive quality. So they're scientific phenomena which can be explained in terms of the basic principles of science, yet they seem to have something very emotional about them. They're like, they blow over like emotions do. And so I think for all these reasons, they're rather intriguing. And then, of course, you know, we all love a sunset, and a sunset, the beauty of a sunset comes from the clouds.
Gavin, this is Mark Seeley. I just wanted to pay you a compliment. I think your Cloud Spotter's Guide is one of the best books I've read in recent years.
Oh, that's so kind of you.
It's very, very engaging, and I find it easy to get caught up in your narrative. I actually got it over, my wife got it for me when we were over in your country last October, so I have the UK version of your book.
Right.
But what I was fascinated with also was the Cloud Appreciation Society, if I'm not mistaken, is now over 8,000 members, is that right?
That's right. It's been a surprise to me almost how much it's grown. I think it's really a society of the internet age, in that the great thing about clouds is that they have no interest and they don't respect political boundaries or geographic boundaries, and so the fact that the internet is this tool for uniting people who have an interest in clouds is really one reason why it's grown in a kind of organic way. It seems to have grown like, you know, the way that things grow virally on the internet. People tell their friends, they email other people. And so, yes, we've got over 8,000 members in, I think it's 44 countries now.
Oh,
my goodness. Well, you know, the other feature that I was struck with in viewing your website is, as an educator, of course, I'm teaching atmospheric science to all kinds of age groups here. And your array of cloud photos in your galleries is, to me, about as comprehensive as anything I've seen. Now, there are institutes of higher education that have somewhat limited cloud galleries, you know, to illustrate the basic Luke Howard classification system. But yours is just enormous. I couldn't believe the number on there.
I know. The funny thing is that, you know, it's sort of happened naturally, do you know what I mean? It's not happened through any great effort. I mean, there is an effort in the sense that when the images come in, we you know, have to decide what cloud type to catalog them under, as it were. But really, the interesting thing is that it's a matter of, because the people who come to the site are people who are interested in taking photographs of clouds, they naturally send them in. And so there's this sort of network of people all across the world who are looking up and are thinking, when they see an interesting cloud, they think, I'll take a photograph of that and send it into the society. And so it really has built up, you know, just in this organic way, which is something I like about it.
Well, while we've been chatting this morning, I've been watching these cumulus clouds floating outside overhead and very scenic with a blue sky. And there was a meteorologist in the States here that about 10 years ago decided to come up with some sort of cloud awareness. And he called it Sky Awareness Week. We just went by that in April. It had come and gone. But I was wondering, I'm intrigued as I look at these clouds, and we have the cumulus and the stratus and the ultrastratus and the cirrus. I always got a kick out of, or tried to capture, the essence of these words that were put on the end of these, you know, type of things, the nimbostratus and the mammatus and those types of things. Do you have any favorite words that describe these clouds that have formal type of names?
Well, I mean, they all sound a bit scary sometimes, all those Latin names. And I tried to make fun of the formality of the naming system, because people who are not familiar with Latin terms, I guess that, you know, can be a bit put off by them. But, I mean, the interesting thing is that all they're doing is describing two things in the names. One is how high it is, whether it's low cloud, a middle cloud, or a high cloud, because that's how they're that's sort of divided up. And the other is to say simply what they look like. So the cumulus clouds you have outside at the moment, the Latin name just means stacked or heaped, because they're the ones that look like a kind of bunch of cotton wool or a heap of mashed potato or something. I like the cirrus, mm-hmm. cirrus name, because mm-hmm. that's a name for, it's a Latin for a lock of hair. It seems like a good description of the high ice crystal clouds that are cirrus, falling, cascading crystals of ice, which take on these beautiful wavy appearances that they're called fall streaks. I like that name so much that it's my daughter's middle name, Cirrus.
I like that.
I have a certain fondness for the Latin. My daughter is a Latin teacher at Wright State, so she would want me to endorse the Latin, and I'm about the best I can do is the translucius.
Right.
And those sort of things, and the congestus and those
absolutely.
Sorts of things.
Absolutely, yeah, well, they are fantastic, aren't they? I mean, you know, cirrocumulus, cumulonimbus incus capillatus, it sounds almost poetic, doesn't it, when you hear them?
I do love cirrus clouds, those delicate streaks in the sky, as you mentioned, Gavin, and you have a beautiful photo on page 177 of the book. It's a rare formation of a cirrus cloud formation known as Kelvin-Helmholtz. It's a wave cloud, and for all the world, it looks like ocean waves. It's really quite amazing. Do you have a favorite cloud formation, by the way?
Well, I do like... I'm rather partial to lenticular clouds, which, as you probably know, are the ones that form typically in hilly or mountainous regions. And when the atmosphere's a certain way, the air streams that reach a mountain and have to rise to pass over it can have a wavy root in the lee of the mountain. They kind of go up and down in wave-like formations. And at the crest of each of these waves, you sometimes get a cloud forming, which is a very dramatic and beautiful type of cloud, the lenticular cloud. The official name for the Latin lovers would be altocumulus lenticularis. But if you're a glider pilot, you might just call them Lennies. And the great thing about them is that they look like UFOs or flying saucers. And in fact, some of the early black and white UFO, in inverted commas, photographs are actually lenticular clouds. And one of the things I like about them, I like a lot of things about them, but one of the things I like about them is that they hover. If you imagine most clouds would drift along in the breeze. The droplets or the ice crystals are blown along in the breeze, and you see them traveling as they do so sedately on a breezy summer afternoon. But these lenticular clouds hover in spite of what can be quite a brisk breeze. In fact, the droplets blow through the cloud, so they form at the front of the cloud as the air is rising, and the droplets pass through the body of the cloud and then evaporate at the back as the air is sinking again. And so that all the droplets are moving, but the cloud shape itself remains stationary, kind of hovering in the air, a little bit like a stationary wave that you sometimes get in a stream behind a boulder. You know, all the water's moving, but the wave shape's fixed. So I find that interesting and rather beautiful.
These lenticular clouds also sometimes take on very unusual shapes that we can construe as depicting an image of an object or something. And I couldn't help but notice, Gavin, that on, I think it's the cloud chat section of your website, that it's proposed that you and your colleague Ian Loxley are going to do a second book, and you're going to collect photos of cloud forms that depict certain images or things
yes.
like that. Are you well underway on that topic?
It's all pretty much done. I've just about sent it off to the printers. It's something that we encourage people to do, is to send in photographs of clouds that look like things, because it's, you know, with all this science is all well and good, but one of the pleasures of cloud spotting and sitting and watching the clouds is to let one's imagination drift along with them and
right.
to see the, you know, to see what shapes appear to you. So I really felt that perhaps that was something that we hadn't really explored enough in the first book, and it's a collection of our favorites of the photographs of clouds that look like things that members have sent in. And there's just some brilliant ones in there. There's, you know, there is a UFO one, like one of these lenticular clouds. There's a great one of a dog's head from Australia. There's a, what was the best one? Possibly Salvador Dali.
Oh,
the profile of Salvador Dali, even his curling moustache is visible.
Wow.
This will be something that people can give to young kids. You know, the Cloud Spotter's Guide is... there's too many words for kids who are sort of 6, 7, 8. And so this... But this will kind of fill that gap for, you know, cloud spotters of all ages.
Final question, Craig?
Well, I think this book would be great to put in Weather Service office. When I first started with the Weather Service in the 70s, my job for the first 3 years was going out observing the clouds. And I think there's a tendency now to lose that. Can meteorologists run right to a computer screen, look for the clouds on the satellite imagery, go outside, observe the sky, make sure that the meteorologist is as much of an art as it is a science. So I think it's a great book to have in a library to get people out there looking at the clouds and say, show me, tell me what you're seeing in these clouds today. Beautiful.
Fantastic. I mean, that's exactly right. I think there's this double-edged thing going on with as the forecasters and meteorologists get better and better at their craft, which they undoubtedly are. They're getting so good at predicting the weather now. As this happens, people need less and less to look up, and this is there's a flip side of the situation, and there's a danger of us becoming meteorologically autistic in the sense that, if clouds are expressions of the atmosphere, they give you an idea of what the mood of the atmosphere is and what the mood is changing into. If they're these expressions, then we're in danger of losing our understanding of what those expressions mean. And that's what I mean by a kind of meteorological autism. Do you see what I mean? I think that's one reason why in the society I kind of am campaigning for people to remember, the clouds are one of nature's most beautiful displays and a display that's available for all to see. So it's really important just to remember to keep looking up.
That was Gavin Praetor-Pinney, founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society in Great Britain. Gavin's written many books on cloud gazing, and his latest, The Cloud Collector's Handbook, is due out next year. Well, the weather website of the week is taking the week off as well, but we want to remind you that there's absolutely no limits to the topics that the Jet Streaming team will investigate for you. So drop us a line by way of the Jet Streaming web page at minnesotapublicradio.org and see if your question or comment pops up on a future edition of our podcast. And that, my friends, is a wrap on this best of version of Jet Streaming. For Mark, Craig, Paul, and producers Jim Bickle and P. Ray Rudolph, I'm Kathy Werzer. Thanks for listening, and remember to keep an ear here to Jet Streaming and your weather eye on the sky.